Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frey, is at the controls. The International Criminal Court opened its doors 6 years ago to prosecute those accused of genocide and crimes against humanity. More than 100 states are members. The United States is not one of them. This morning in this part of Focus, we'll be talking a little bit about the mission of the court and also its relationship to other international bodies charged with investigating war crimes. And our guest for the program is David Scheffer. He is professor of law at Northwestern University Law School, where he is also the director of the Center for International Human Rights. He teaches international human rights law and international criminal law. He also served as the U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes issues. This was between 1997 and 2001, and he also led the U.S. delegation in U.N. talks establishing the International Criminal Court. During the first term of the Clinton administration, he also served as a senior advisor and counsel to the U.S. representative to the United Nations, that at that time was Madeleine Albright. He also served from 1993 through 1996 on the Deputies Committee of the International Security Council. He's going to be joining us by telephone here. We'll get him set up in just a moment, and we'll be happy to talk with him and also to entertain questions from people who are listening. The number, if you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So those are the two numbers. Again, one for folks here where we are in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and we do also have that toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, certainly feel free to pick up the telephone and join us. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments brief, just so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. Professor Scheffer, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm very pleased to do so.
Just as a very basic question to start with, what is the mission of the International Criminal Court?
Well, the mission is to bring to international justice the leading perpetrators of atrocity crimes in the world, namely genocide, what we call crimes against humanity, and serious war crimes. It's a leadership crime court. In other words, it's not designed to bring foot soldiers and mid-level and low-level ranking military personnel to justice. That's to be dealt with in other types of courts. This is a court designed to bring the leaders, the planners, who actually design how the strategy for genocide, for ethnic cleansing, those types of crimes. How do you investigate them, and how do you prosecute them effectively? And that's what the International Criminal Court is designed to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I sat down and started thinking about this immediately, I became confused. And to eliminate the possibility of confusion, or possibly to confuse people more, we have another body with a very similar sounding name. It's located in the same city.
Yes.
This is the International Court of Justice.
Correct.
Sometimes also known as the World Court. So what is the difference between the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court?
The difference is that in the international, or before the International Court of Justice, which you just called the World Court, mm-hmm. only governments, nations, can litigate in that court. In other words, only governments can bring claims against each other in that court. You cannot bring a criminal case against an individual before that court. It has to be a government standing at each table, one government at one table, another government at another table, arguing an issue such as a territorial dispute or a law of sea dispute of some character. A use of force dispute between two countries, a diplomatic dispute. Those are the types of disputes that are brought before the International Court of Justice and have been ever since World War II, when it was created, right after World War II. And before that, it was called the Permanent Court of international justice, and it was created with the League of Nations. So that court has been around for a long, long time. And the United States has appeared before it many, many times. The other court is the International Criminal Court, and that has been with us only since July of 2002. And that before that court, you cannot prosecute a government. It's not a court that where we would call state responsibility is at issue. It's a court where individual criminal responsibility is at issue, and you've got to have a live human being in that court as a defendant being charged with criminal charges to be brought to justice under criminal law. And so that is the very fundamental distinction between the two courts.
All right. So that's not difficult to understand to the way that you've laid it out there. Well, then let me ask one further question, because there are now underway at least two, international criminal tribunals. There's one for the former Yugoslavia. There's one for Rwanda. Now, these are also under the auspices of the United Nations, as is the World Court. It's the similar sort of brief, and yet these are not connected with the International Criminal Court?
That's correct. Those three courts that you just identified are United Nations courts. In other words, the International Court of Justice, which has been around ever since, 1920, 21, in different ways, where governments litigate against each other's. And then the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia, and then one for Rwanda. We call them the Hague Tribunal and the Arusha Tribunal or the Rwanda Tribunal. Those two tribunals are criminal tribunals that were established by the United Nations Security Council as part of their brief to secure international peace and security. And this is the judicial side of that issue, where you need to bring the perpetrators of these atrocity crimes to justice to help stabilize the society and assist with the goal of international peace and security. So the UN created those two courts, and they are United Nations courts, and UN member states pay through their assessments to the UN for the expenses of those courts, all three of them. That's on one side of the brief. The International Criminal Court, the permanent International Criminal Court that's been around since July of 2002, is not a United Nations court. It was created through negotiations at the UN, but its actual establishment is by treaty among governments. And the states parties of those governments come together in a treaty to build a court and obligate themselves to that court. And that is exactly what has happened, but it's outside of the UN system. Now, interestingly for your audience, it's never quite as simple as one might explain it, of course. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of complicating strands here, which is there's an agreement between the International Criminal Court and the United Nations to cooperate with each other. We call it a relationship agreement. Because there are certain connecting bridges between the UN and the International Criminal Court out of sheer logic. There are some connecting bridges in terms of how the Security Council might interact with that court, etc. And so we have a relationship agreement which sets up a certain methodology of operation between the UN system and the International Criminal Court. And the same thing holds in an interesting way for two other courts, the Special Court for Sierra Leone, which is prosecuting Charles Taylor right now, and the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, which is prosecuting the Khmer Rouge leadership right now. Those two courts are not UN courts, but they have relationship agreements, cooperation agreements with the United Nations.
Well, hopefully we now haven't lost people in this maze of trying to get these various entities kind of sorted out and the relationship to one another. I suppose really the important question here, particularly it has to do with the International Criminal Court, which, as you explained, has been around just only for 6 years, since 2002, is why it was obviously deemed to be important that this thing be created.
Yeah.
Was there then, and to do, as you say, to to bring to justice people who were accused of genocide and war crimes and crimes against humanity. Was there no way to do this before, or was there some idea that by creating this body, it would facilitate the prosecution of people who were accused of those sorts
right.
of crimes?
There was a way to do it before, and in fact, many of those ways are still with us. Everyone will remember the Nuremberg trials, the Tokyo trials after World War II. That was one way of doing it after World War II. Those were called military tribunals set up by the United States and the Allied powers. We had a long drought between Nuremberg and the 1990s in terms of these types of courts. And when the Balkans conflict erupted in the early 1990s, when the Rwandan genocide occurred, when in 1994, when the civil war in Sierra Leone, you know, completely blew up towards the end of the 1990s, all of those situations begged for the rendering of justice. And yet we had situations in those countries where the courts simply were not functioning effectively enough. In fact, they were devastated. It was very important, at least the international community thought it was very important, to try to set up courts to deal with the justice issues as quickly as possible. So the UN created this means of doing so through the Security Council. However, it became a very expensive proposition. Imagine it. You know, every time there's an atrocity situation in the world, you have to set up a new court with new judges, with new prosecutors, with new defense counsel, with new buildings and new courtrooms. That is millions, hundreds of millions of dollars every time you do it. And there's not a lot of enthusiasm at the UN to do that kind of thing time and time and time again. I called it by the mid-1990s, tribunal fatigue had set in at the UN. And so a lot of people started saying, well, wait a minute, why do we have to keep building these separate courts? Let's create a permanent international criminal court that is on deck, has one set of judges, one set of prosecutors, has a list of defense counsel, one building. And as these atrocities occur, we can basically pitch the justice issue into the permanent international criminal court and stop spending so much money building individual tribunals for individual atrocities. And so that's sort of in a nutshell how it happened.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with David Sheffer. He's professor of law at Northwestern University Law School. He's also director of the Center for International Human Rights there. He served as U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues between 1997 and 2001, and he also led the U.S. delegation in U.N. talks establishing the International Criminal Court. And primarily, that's what we're talking about here this morning. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. One very important issue here that we want to get to, and that is to talk about the involvement of the United States or the lack of involvement of the United States. There are several major nations that are not. There are more than 100 states that are members of the court, but there are several major countries that are not, including China, India, and the United States. To what extent is it, do you think, a significant problem, either for the United States or for international justice or for the International Criminal Court, that the United States is not part of this?
Well, it's a very good question. As of October of this year, namely a month from now, there will be 108 countries as states parties to the court. And they include in that group almost every single American ally out there. Our NATO allies, our friends in Latin America, many of the major friends we have in Asia and Africa. Most of our allies and friends are now party to the court. We have some very major countries that are not party yet. As you mentioned, China and India, but let's also include Russia and Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, a few African countries, although most African countries have now joined on. It's unfortunate that the club that is not party to the court now While it includes the United States and some major countries like China and Russia and stuff, it also includes what we would describe as the rogue states, the authoritarian states, the non-democratic states. Those are not part of the process yet. So we're in sort of a strange club of non-participation in the court. Strong democracies are part of the court. Our allies are part. So I just want to put that in context. Now, your question is, you know, what's the significance of all of that? I think for the United States, and I was, of course, part of this whole process, we ultimately signed the Rome Statute to the court, meaning the treaty for the court, on December 31st of 2000 under the Clinton administration. So we signaled our intention to commit ourselves to this court and ultimately try to achieve ratification of the treaty in the U.S. Senate, although we knew at the time we had nowhere near the votes for it. But that's what happens with treaties. You know, it took us 40 years to ratify the Genocide Convention after we signed it. I mean, these things just take time in the U.S. Senate. But I think for the United States, the significance now is that over the last 8 years, and I'll have to express a little bit of partisanship here because I was obviously with the Clinton administration when we were at the leading edge of international justice. In the last 8 years, we've seen quite a retreat. We've lost our leadership position. And the longer we stay out of the International Criminal Court, the more and more, frankly, the United States becomes irrelevant to the issue of international justice because so much is being developed in that court in terms of the law, how it's developing in the cases, in the among the judges, etc. Our friends and allies are part of the process of determining now where that court will direct its attention, what situations will be prosecuted. We're not part of that discussion anymore. We're out of it. And as each year goes by, we lose more and more influence in that discussion. So for the United States, it's a leadership issue. We're losing it. We've slipped way behind on international justice. I think for countries like China and Russia, you know, never underestimate Russia. I mean, I think if you just look at Georgia over the last few weeks, do not underestimate Russia. They will seize opportunities to trump us. Now, they've already signed the treaty. They have signed the Rome Statute to the International Criminal Court. And there's always been discussion in Moscow of when will they take the dive to become a state party. If they become a state party at some point, they trump us, in a sense, in terms of then they become part of the International Justice Club. And they wield their influence as a major player in the International Criminal Court. I think it's very unlikely China will join for a long, long time to come. But countries like India and Pakistan, are a little bit more, Indonesia, they're a little bit more on the fringe of maybe 10 years from now, 15 years from now, you'll see them start to step forward for the court. The court has been able to mature over the last 5 to 6 years. It's taken on 4 situations to investigate and prosecute. It's received sufficient funding from the more than 100 members. So it's a viable court. And it's frankly moving on without the United States.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. We will start with someone here where we are in Champaign County. This is our line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Well, I think the criminality of the U.S. government is why the current regime, and I wonder about others actually joining later. An interesting anecdote is that Kucinich's talk to the convention yesterday was one phrase was taken out, and it's a good line. It goes, they want 4 more years, and they should get 10 to 20. the lack of commitment to prosecuting our own problems actually is a legal concept. Scott Horton, I think, said that because of some of the provisions in the Military Commissions Act giving exculpating people, mm-hmm. actually means that other jurisdictions, that is, other nations, and this has been done and upheld, have to rise to the occasion. If a government doesn't gives immunity to certain crimes, and someone else is obliged to take care of it, and it's just serving justice. Now people will say that's overblown and not relative to the world. This criminal court of the world, which is predicated on massive crimes, but it seems to me that 600,000 to a million excessive deaths in Iraq with a war that wasn't authorized by the UN. I mean, there were a lot of deaths in Iraq before that, but due to the sanctions, and Dennis Halliday called it a genocidal sanctions regime. He used to enforce it or work with the UN. I'm throwing up a lot here, but the criminality of this government, I think, does rise to the level of this kind of prosecution eventually, possibly. There's no there's a battery of books about this. The head of the National Lawyers Guild, Marjorie Cohn, has six ways the Bush gang has broken the law, and there's the prosecutor who has filed a brief for prosecution of Bush for murder, saying that any district attorney with the colonies could do it. So I think the idea of focusing on, of course, there are a lot of genocides going on, but the way they seem to be selectively prosecuted, where they're not in the Congo particularly, gives a lie to this as a commitment to justice, and it's more of the justice by the victors kind of.
Let me jump in at this point.
Sure, surely. Sure.
Excellent points that you've raised. Let me try to take on as many of them as I can, as briefly as I can. There is an interesting comparison between then and now. Back in the 1990s, when I was negotiating all of this and ultimately signing the treaty on December 31st of 2000, I always said publicly that the ICC is going to need the United States, and therefore listen to what we have to say. You know, let's negotiate fairly as to how this court should be structured, et cetera, because the ICC will need the U.S. You're going to need us as a major funder of the court, quite frankly. We'll be assessed a good percentage of the cost of the court because of the size of our economy, et cetera. We have diplomatic and military power that the court is going to want to draw upon, et cetera. A role in the Security Council, et cetera. So, it was, I think, a valid point to make in the 1990s that the ICC will need the United States. So let's get on board. Let's make this work. I have to say that after 8 years of the Bush administration, a lot of us sit back and say, my God, maybe the United States needs the ICC. I mean, if you look at the performance of this administration and the legal issues that have been raised, some of which you've mentioned in your comments, it's a very distressing sudden reversal of where we thought our country was heading with the rule of law and in this sort of new era of international justice coming out of the 1990s. So that's very distressing. I will say that there are some technical issues that allow us, I think, to feel, shall we say, more comfortable about thinking of a future role in the ICC without triggering the sort of the paranoia out there that, oh my God, if we join the ICC, is everyone going to be prosecuted for what happened in the Bush administration? And the reason I say that is, A, and you made mention of this, by the way, we have our own federal courts. We have our own U.S. attorneys. We have something called the War Crimes Act of 1996 that makes a lot of this a felony. A lot of us have been waiting a long time for a U.S. attorney to step forward and actually use those laws. So it's not as if the United States can't look at its own issues of accountability within its own courts. it can do so. And one would hope that all of those serious issues will be properly considered where they should be considered in our own system. But when it comes to the International Criminal Court, it's a much more complicated issue because it's an issue of jurisdiction. The court does not have what we call universal jurisdiction. You have to satisfy preconditions for jurisdiction in terms of, you know, whether or not you're committing crimes on the territory of a state party to the court or whether your nationals are part of a state party to the court. And, for example, in Iraq, we don't satisfy those criteria at all, so the court simply doesn't have jurisdiction over how we have performed in Iraq. However, because Iraq itself is not a state party to the court, but in Afghanistan, Afghanistan is a state party to the International Criminal Court. And so it's fair game for the court to look at what's going on in Afghanistan, and it is doing so. It's actually reviewing the Afghan situation as we speak. So another point is that the court, in many ways, does not have what we call ex post facto jurisdiction. In other words, it's not going to look back at the 1990s, for example. Its start point is July 1, 2002. It can't look at anything that happened before then. And even after July 1, 2002, there are lots of hurdles that have to be jumped in order to slot a particular country and its leaders into a means of jurisdiction for the court. So I won't get into all of that because I probably want to get on to others, but there's a little bit more of a complication in terms of how to trigger the court's jurisdiction.
We are past our midpoint here. I have another caller I want to get on to. I want to invite others and also introduce again our guest for anyone who has just tuned in. We are talking this morning with David Scheffer. He's professor of law at Northwestern University Law School. He's also director of the Center for International Human Rights. He was previously the U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues, that between 1997 and 2001, and he led the U.S. delegation in U.N. talks establishing the International Criminal Court. And that is what we're talking about here this morning. Also, during the first term of the Clinton administration, he served as senior advisor and counsel to the U.S. representative to the U.N. at that time, Madeleine Albright. He also served from 1993 through 96 on the Deputies Committee of the National Security Council. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our next caller is in Bloomington, Indiana, and that's line 4. Hello.
Hi. Before I ask my main question, let me ask a preliminary question. What lawmaking body makes international law? Is it the United Nations?
Well, very quickly, actually, it's governments that make international law. They do so by entering into treaties which ultimately reflect what they believe are principles of international law. And they also create courts such as the International Court of Justice in The Hague, which is a court they've agreed to take cases to interpret what the law should be. And there's a final element of international law, which we call customary international law, whereby as scholars and judges and others look at how nations have behaved over hundreds of years, they throw a lot into the pot. They throw treaties, they throw state practice, and then they conclude, well, look, this is how the world understands this particular issue should be dealt with by states, and we call that international law. So it's sort of a complex of different sources of law.
Okay. Well, that my main question, in order for any court to be viable, to be effective, it must have some type of a police force. Stronger, that police force has to be stronger than any defendant who might be summoned before the court, because if there's no such enforcing mechanism, the criminals will simply ignore the court. Where is the International Criminal Court's police force?
Well, of course, it would be a rather huge stride to actually create a international police force for the International Criminal Court, because you're still dealing with sovereign countries which have agreed by their own sovereign decisions to enter the court, to be party to the court. And it was enough of a challenge just to get them to agree to that. I think if we had thrown in the idea of a police force, that you know, would have some sort of unbridled power to enter their territory and take down fugitives, it would have been a very, very difficult negotiation. But your point is very, very valid. And there is a lot of discussion that I've been involved in myself here at Northwestern in recent years of, have we now reached a point with the International Criminal Court, now that it's set up, now that it's operating, now that it's investigating, now that it's indicted individuals? There are indicted fugitives running around in Africa. There are a couple that are in custody in The Hague now. And yet it's very difficult to track and apprehend some of these. Would it not be useful to have, whether you call it an international marshal service or an international police component of some sort, which would have the specialized skills and that would assist with tracking and apprehending fugitives from the court, but you would have to set up a new sort of protocol with governments whereby they would agree to consent to have these individuals on their territory to do that tracking and apprehending. In other words, you can't just send them in without visas and without permission of the governments. But if you could get their advance permission that on a case-by-case basis, we're going to present you with this specialized force of police, and you can on a case-by-case basis consent or deny to admitting them, at least there's the option then of having a really useful and skilled unit that can go in and try to track them down and apprehend them. And I think that's a very serious concept out there, and it may take 10, 15 years for it to be fully matured and agreed to, but it is definitely on the table.
Thank you very much.
All right. Yeah. Well, and now I guess what you would be relying on would be that if the court issues an indictment, indicts an individual, that you're relying on the law enforcement or the military or the police or the government of countries that are parties to the court to do their bit to apprehend that person and then turn them over.
That's correct. That's exactly how it works. And when you become a state party to the Rome Statute of the ICC, which is the governing treaty of the court, you agree that if a court indicts someone and that someone is on your territory, you will respond to the arrest warrant that's issued by the court, and you will go out there and arrest that person and then transfer him to the court if he's on your territory. So there is an obligation to do that, but of course in so many situations it's very difficult, particularly in developing parts of the world where sometimes the militia can outsmart, you know, the local police and military and remain at large, particularly in places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where so much of the territory simply cannot even be accessed for that purpose. So that's the difficulty. And then there's just the political will. I mean, at what point in time does that particular government devote enough resources to tracking and then arresting that individual? And at what risk to its own soldiers and police does it do so?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, and certainly a case in point would be, and obviously this is a different body, but sort of certainly a case in point would be the Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. You know, think about how long Radovan Karadzic had been under indictment before he was finally apprehended, and we still Ratko Mladic is probably one of the people who is on the top list of wanted war criminals around the world.
Precisely.
And he is still at large somewhere, and the issues of political will and cost of apprehending someone like that certainly apply, and they're not underdeveloped countries.
That's right. And frankly, during the 90s, when we were tracking and trying to arrest Karadzic in the Balkans and Mladic and many others, you know, you run up against this issue, whether it be within our military or within some of our NATO allies' militaries, at what level of risk do you put your own soldiers in order to accomplish an arrest? I mean, how many soldiers would you risk their lives to accomplish that? And that's a very real-world question, you know, that you have to confront, because you will be told there is a risk in going into that mountainous region to track this guy and take him down, you know. And oftentimes the response will be that they want to do it, provided they can not only minimize but eliminate any risk in doing so. So that gets you into the whole strategy of tracking and apprehension. And for example, today I wish we could say to the Serbian government, we have a very specialized tracking team. We want you to invite this tracking team into your country, and we're going to work with you to locate General Mladic and bring him to justice. You know, but that's not exactly the way it works these days.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. We have someone on a cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to know how it's proposed to track or to bring non-governmental entities such as the Taliban or Al-Qaeda under the jurisdiction of the tribunals. And have you addressed that? Because they certainly are not signatories to the treaties. They're not about to, and they don't apply to any nation.
Well,
and I'll hang up and listen.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
I think what you may be referring to is the old argument from the beginning of the Afghan intervention in 2001 of, you know, do the Geneva Conventions of 1949 apply to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, or do they not? I don't think we need to go into that discussion too far in order to answer your question with respect to the International Criminal Court. The Taliban are citizens of Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a state party to the International Criminal Court. End of discussion. They're covered. I mean, they're nationals of a state party to the court, and that's it. It doesn't matter if they don't consider themselves part, or if there's a question about whether they're part of the government. Of course they're not anymore. Taliban is not the government. But that doesn't matter for the International Criminal Court. You don't have to be a government agent to fall within the jurisdiction of the court. You just have to be someone, whether you're part of a militia, some non-governmental military effort. But if you go out there and actually fulfill the elements of crime for genocide, for crimes against humanity, or war crimes, you fall within the jurisdiction of the court. It doesn't matter what your relationship is to any particular government, as long as what matters is your citizenship, or whether you're committing the crime on the territory of a state party to the court. I will mention just one thing, though. The Taliban, interestingly, have a long record of atrocity crimes when they ran the government of Afghanistan during the 1990s, and there's always been a lot of discussion about whether one could create a special court to prosecute them for those crimes during the 1990s. It wouldn't be part of the ICC because it's before the ICC was built, but that issue is still out there. And the second point is terrorism as a crime is not part of the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. It just is not. I mean, it could be, but it's not at this time. And so, particularly with Al-Qaeda, if you're looking at them in terms of terrorism and crimes of terrorism, you might have a much more difficult time bringing them into the jurisdiction of the ICC than you would if you could get them on crimes against humanity, for example.
We have about 10 minutes left. Very quickly, let me introduce again our guest for anyone who's tuned in here. Since the bottom of the hour, we're talking with David Sheffer. He's professor of law at Northwestern University. He teaches international human rights law and international criminal law. He's also director of the Center for International Human Rights. We're talking about the International Criminal Court. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You touched a little bit earlier on an issue that I was interested in, and I don't know if this is too obviously it's complicated. I don't know if it's too complicated to talk about, but the basic question is, how does the court go about deciding what conditions, what situations they're going to investigate and who they're going to indict?
Right. Well, it's a pretty straightforward answer. The court's interest can be triggered by a referral of that situation. Let's say it's, you know, let's say Georgia, you know, the most recent problem in the nation of Georgia, where there have been allegations of a lot of killing and civilians and ethnic cleansing and everything. That situation could be brought to the court's attention by a referral by an existing state party to the court. I mean, South Africa, if it wanted to, it's a state party. It could say, court, please look at Georgia. We're referring Georgia to you today. Please start reviewing and seeing if there's a sufficient basis for kicking Georgia into the jurisdiction of the court in terms of the crimes there. Or the Security Council, acting, of course, in the absence of a veto. If there's a veto, this wouldn't happen. But the Security Council could refer Georgia to the International Criminal Court and request the court to review it and determine whether or not there's enough there to investigate and start prosecutions. The third way is the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court can say, wait a minute, I'm, you know, reading the newspapers here, and this looks pretty obvious to me. I'm going to start my own review of Georgia, but I can't trigger the court myself. What he can do is he can say, okay, I've reviewed this. I think there's a really strong case to bring Georgia to the ICC. And what I'm going to do now is present my findings to the judges, and they will make a determination as to whether or not I've met the test, you know, for triggering the jurisdiction of the court on Georgia. So those are the three ways that that a matter can come before the court. And that is, and interestingly enough, I'll make this very quick. In Africa, we have four situations before the court, and the only ones that are before the court. Mm-hmm. We have Darfur. We have Uganda, we have the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and we have the Central African Republic, all with different sets of crimes. Three of those were referred by the states themselves because they couldn't handle the prosecutions domestically, and they wanted the court to take on the crimes. Darfur was referred by the Security Council, but the other three were... You know, Uganda referred its situation, Democratic Republic referred its own situation, and the Central African Republic referred, and they're all states' parties to the court.
It was my understanding that the very first trial, this was of Thomas Lubanga, who was involved in the situation in the Congo, the Congolese militia leader. It was supposed to begin in June, and then it was stopped because the judges ruled that the prosecutor had refused to disclose potentially exculpatory material, and that had breached Mr. Lubanga's right to fair trial.
Precisely.
And I suppose this gets into the issue of, you know, when you're dealing with somebody who is accused of genocide or war crimes or crimes against humanity, this is very serious. These are indeed very serious crimes at the same in time, and you may in fact feel that person is deserving of prosecution and punishment. At the same time, you want to make sure that they get maximum due process and that the trials are fairly conducted. Is that a difficult line to walk?
I think it's a difficult one, but it's one the court is definitely walking. It's really remarkable. We have, we lawyers, of course, read all of these decisions, and we've seen in recent months, you know, how many decisions are coming down from what we call the pretrial chamber and then the appeals chamber of the court on these pretrial issues that are very, very concentrated on the due process rights of the defendant. So the court has been very protective of those due process rights. It goes to the integrity of the court. I might just say that it's not, you know, there's always another side to this issue with Lubanga. The prosecutor has had a difficulty with this particular body of evidence, which he has not turned over to the defense counsel for Lubanga, because the evidence comes from United Nations
peacekeepers and others on the ground in the Congo, and the evidence was provided confidentially to the prosecutor as what we call lead evidence. In other words, the prosecutor gets it. He can't bring it into the courtroom, but he can use it as a signal of where else to look for evidence. And so often in the field, you have humanitarian workers, you have missionaries, you have peacekeepers who, if they become entangled in this judicial process and become known for that reason, they put their own lives at risk in the field. And so there's a very sophisticated process with the court in terms of how do you get that evidence, but then can you bring it into the courtroom? Or must it be disclosed to defense counsel? And that's what the court's struggling with, but they did try to discipline the prosecutor to say, look, you can't go too far on this. You know, if you get really exculpatory material, we're going to draw the line at some point, and you're going to need to disclose that to defense counsel. And if you can't, then you may be jeopardizing your entire case. And so that's what they're struggling with on the Lubanga situation right now. It's very complex.
We have one more caller here. We will try to get in very quickly in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Two things. The if I read the paper right, the U.S. paid $40 million reward fee for the arrest of Slobodan Milosevic and sent him to the court. And then the other thing I'm not clear on is there, I think it was Romania, where the locals overwhelmed the old Soviet sympathizer in Romania, I think, and he and his wife were shot down in cold blood, and then they went from there. I'll ring off. Thanks.
Well, let me just take the first one. I had not seen the $40 million figure. We always had. We started this under the Clinton administration. We had a $5 million figure out there for anyone who had information that would lead to the successful capture and bringing to justice of Radovan Karadzic or Ratko Mladic and others. So I don't know about the $40 million, but it wouldn't surprise me if what led everyone to Karadzic ultimately resulted in a $5 million payment being made to someone somewhere. But I don't know anything about that. I'm not in the government. In terms of Romania, I think you're talking about Ceausescu, as I recall.
Yes.
Well, that's the way the Romanians handled it. You know, they were quite impatient, and. It's not what a lawyer would recommend be the way to handle a situation of someone who has committed egregious crimes against his own people. You'd prefer to have a trial and a proper sentence rendered against that individual, but sometimes you know, those situations accelerate far more than you would wish they would.
Just real quickly, here we have a couple of minutes left. It's my understanding that the budget for the court for this year is something a little bit over 90 million euros.
Right.
Most of that, a little over half, comes from the EU, and the next most significant contributor is Japan, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
That sounds like 90 million euros sounds like a lot of money, although I'm sure that to do this kind of work is expensive because you need an awful lot of people to do the various work involved. Is that level of funding, do you think, adequate?
Well, I think it's, you know, that's a loaded question. Because, of course, adequate means, you know, how far can you push the envelope of potential work, you know, by the mm-hmm. court? Mm-hmm. I think what they do is they draw up a budget that they try to that should reflect the needs that they have for the situations they're investigating, four in Africa. Plus, they have several others that are under review, but no formal investigations have begun. For example, they have Colombia, the country of Colombia, under review. They have Afghanistan under review. They have Kenya under review. But that hasn't triggered the much larger expenses of an investigation. Now, if they were to trigger any one of those into a full-fledged investigation, then suddenly you have a blip on your budget, you know, and you've got to stoke up that budget to cover your expenses.
But I think it's probably, you know, fairly adequate for what they're doing at this time. But that the budget of this court will vary depending on the types of situations it has to investigate and the expenses that are accrued. And that's part of the budgeting process each year. They have to get their budget approved by the Assembly of States parties. So it's really the governments in the end who are party to the court who make those decisions as to, you know, how much resources does this court have to achieve what objectives? And money will, in the end, sort of determine how far the court can go in doing this kind of work. Japan, by the way, was the 105th state party, joined in October of 2007, and because of its economy, it has now become the nation that has the single largest assessment in the budget against it.
I find that to be very interesting. Why is it the way that it works out, or was this somehow a decision on the part of the government of Japan?
No, not at all. It's they use roughly the assessment scale of the UN.
Ah.
If you're a member state to the UN, then they look at your GDP, and then they slot in, you know, the wealthiest economies and then the next wealthiest, etc. That's why the United States still has the top rung at the UN, because we still are the wealthiest economy, so we have to pay the largest assessment into the UN. They use roughly the same formula for the ICC, but only with respect to those who have joined the ICC. So they have 108 economies that they look at.
And we have mentioned that you worked in the Clinton administration, so we'll take that into consideration as we hear your answer to this question. But do you think that it is likely that the next president, whoever the next president is, would think differently about our membership in the court?
I think the answer to that is yes, whether it is Senator Obama or Senator McCain. I think both of them have a sort of a broader view of what the importance of the court is. I think that they would each approach it somewhat differently, of course, but I still think that they would have a different approach and perhaps a more cooperative approach to the issue. But I can't speak for them. I'm just saying I think both candidates, from what they've said publicly in the past about the court, would have a more open mind about it.
We will have to leave it at that, with our thanks to our guest, David Sheffer. He's professor of law at Northwestern University Law School, also director of the Center for International Human Rights there. Professor Sheffer, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.